When I was a child, my mother told me that if I could put salt on a bird's tail, I could catch it. Did any of you ever do that? Okay, my brother and I would often go out. At least I remember going out several times. I remember my brother and I would take the salt shaker. I was about 7, and I believed my mother. Remember, this is a woman who told me not to eat the whole apple, or apple trees would grow out of my ears, and I would study myself in the mirror, and I would look and see, and I would turn as far as I could. And she said, don't put anything in your ears, only your elbows. So I would try to put my elbows in my ears. I couldn't. And I thought, why would she say that? I can't get my elbows in my ears. But anyway, this was a lady who liked to have fun. And, send us snipe hunting. But if you want to catch a bird, sprinkle salt in its tail. I can just remember as a kid trying to sneak up on robins. I don't know if anybody was ever taking a picture. I would love to see myself today trying to do that. But I did it many times. And I remember just thinking, this is hard. Every time I get close, that bird is gone. But which tantalized me more, because if I could get that salt on that bird's tail, I could catch it. And I could, obviously I couldn't catch chipmunks. I chased those. I chased squirrels. And we were one of those families that had hamsters, dogs, cats. My favorite bird was named Bluey, and it was blue, fish of every kind my sister had, and we always had two dogs, and usually a cat, and sometimes several cats, and I was talking to my brother on the phone last night. He was calling about a matter, and he stopped. He said, wait a minute. My dog just wiped out my cat. And, we started remembering stories. And the cat was standing at this empty feeder. It's fun to watch animals. And little kids love animals. My dad gave me a BB gun. He said, don't shoot the bird. So I went straight out and shot a bird and killed it. And my dad took the BB gun. It was the world's shortest time to own a BB gun. And if he said, shoot the bird, I probably would have never thought to shoot the bird. I couldn't hit him with salt, but I remember that BB going right through there like it was nothing, and a dead robin. Turn to Matthew 5:13. I think you're going to find some fascinating things the Bible reveals about salt. I'm not going to tell you how to put salt on a bird's tail, because I'm now old enough that I have figured out it cannot be done unless that bird is in a cage. Matthew 5 and verse 13. You are, Christ said near the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, you are, and he could be saying that to us today, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost its savor, its zest, wherewith shall it be salted? Now we're going to find out that actually can't happen to salt itself. There are things that can affect salt, but we'll talk about that. It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden underfoot of men. You are the salt of the earth. Now, if Christ tells you you're the salt of the earth, should you not understand what that means? I would imagine most of you had salt this morning if you had eggs. Depends on what you had, and probably you'll have some salt tonight. Maybe it's veg sal. Maybe it'll be some other kind of natural salt. I guess there's herbal salts, different kinds of salts. But you may not think about that salt unless it's missing. Then you may say, put some more on. I don't use much salt, but some people do. I use a little. But I understand what salt is. I remember as a child sneaking. My mother didn't like us to eat out of the sugar bowl. Sometimes we would dip the sugar bowl and we'd put a spoon in the sugar bowl, just put it in our mouth, and that was great. And I saw the salt when I was 3 years old one day, and I didn't see the sugar. My mother had put it away, so I took the top off, and I went whoop, and I threw up all over the kitchen. I went running from the house. I was 3 years old, still remember, running from the house, throwing up about every 6 feet, and out through the garage, throwing up, out around the garage, finally stopped, and I had just eaten. and so I had plenty to throw up. And I finally stopped on a pile of hose. And I still remember the last, and it was in a nice big circle on beside the garage, and my last shot hit right in the middle of all that coiled up hose. And there was nothing left that would come. So I that's how a three-year-old learns the difference between salt and sugar, I guess. But that was aversion therapy. Man, I just thought of it. Maybe that's why I don't use much salt now. But if Christ said, "You are the salt of the earth, brethren," again, I will ask you, is it not important to us to understand why he would compare us to salt? What important and meaningful characteristics could salt have for us? Whatever they are, there are apparently a number. We're going to find this isn't the only place salt's mentioned in the Bible. Whatever they are, we better have them if we are the salt of the whole earth. So let's examine closely the attributes and properties of salt and see if we can draw some solid analogies that Christ intended us to draw. Let's learn some lessons from salt. Now, chemically speaking, salt is NaCl. I was never very good at chemistry. I didn't understand it very well, but I understood that much. I was like some of these girls who do well in math. They can memorize everything, and they do well in the test, and they beat the boys who understood it better. I got an A in chemistry the only time I took it, and I thought, I understood almost nothing of chemistry, but I got an A on the final test, and I remember having to explain what salt was, NaCl, which is sodium chloride. Now, it's interesting. Sodium is an explosive, and chlorine, is a poison. Put them together, this explosive and this deadly poison, you take a deep breath of chlorine, and it's bye-bye. And, of course, if you're near an explosion, it's bye-bye. Put them together, and you have an extraordinary substance that Christ said we are like. Obviously, he wouldn't have meant we're explosive and we're poisonous, but it is important to at least understand how you take these two things and you come up with this phenomenal commodity, much more, brethren, much more fascinating than what most of us have probably ever dreamed. Now, 60% of all the salt we use comes from salt beds underground. There are mines all over Italy. The Romans mined salt. There are trucks that drive out underneath Lake Erie, way out beyond Cleveland, and bring salt back under the bottom of Lake Erie. You know, hundreds of feet down, presumably, way below the lake bed. Now, Lake Erie's only about 220 feet deep at its deepest point. It's a shallow pan. That's why it's such a dangerous lake. The deeper lakes are less dangerous in terms of the wave action and so forth. But you don't think of Lake Erie. We may ride a boat tomorrow or the next day up there called the Good Times. And I was just thinking, you just don't think of, as you look out over that lake, 100 or 200 feet down and below the bottom of the lake, there are all kinds of roads, and trucks are bringing salt back. Any of you aware of that? Are any of you aware that there's salt? Okay, some of you were aware. That's interesting. But there are all kinds of salt mines where water can be stored, where various other things are stored. It's amazing how much food the United States has stored in the Missouri and Kansas area underground in old salt mines. But 60% of all the salt we use comes from salt beds underground. It's mined just like any other metal or coal. It is then either crushed or sold as is, and it can be further processed by mixing it with water to form brine, after which the water is evaporated. 25% more of the salt we use comes from extracting it out of wells drilled deep underground. Now you're up to about 85%. It's then piped out under great pressure. The final 15% comes from the oceans and salt lakes. Now, the Great Salt Lake is 4 times saltier than the ocean. I don't know if you've ever been in the Great Salt Lake, but it's 4 times saltier than the ocean, and things will float in it. Things that would sink in regular water, or even sink in the ocean, will float in the Great Salt Lake. The Dead Sea is 13 times saltier than the Great Salt Lake, which makes it 52 times saltier than the ocean. You begin to understand there's a lot of salt there. Now, I did go swimming in the Dead Sea, which reminds me of a joke. I don't know if I've ever told this joke. Just flashed into my mind of these three little boys. I tell that joke? Oh, I have. All right, I told the joke. Well, anyway, now should I tell the joke? If you want to know the joke, ask me later. I think I remember telling it. But anyway, the Dead Sea is just caked with salt on the edge of it. If you walk right up to the water, it's incredibly hot, incredibly salty and hot. You can go out into the water, and I'd heard that you can sit there in a cross-legged Indian style, and you can sit in the water, and you're out of the water from the waist up, and you can read a newspaper. So I thought, I'm going to try that. I went out. Now, I didn't take a newspaper, but I went out there, but it was 105 degrees, and the salt from my own sweat was running into my eyes. And I'll never forget this experience. And so they said, do not, under any circumstances, wipe your eyes. And you forget. I forgot. And I pulled my hands out of the water, wiped my eyes, and the water on my hands was much saltier than my sweat. And it instantly blinded me, and I'm out in the water. And I couldn't see. So I sort of squinted, it was so buoyant, unbelievably buoyant, I ran back to the sand. The sand was so hot you could not put your hands on. So I'm trying to dance across the sand, unbelievably hot, blind, couldn't see, and I finally, they had this place up there, they had all these different showers right up on the beach because people all do it, and they had to stand under the shower, and you know, or you lose your eyesight. So that's how I learned that there's a lot of salt in the Dead Sea. And it's probably the salt that killed it. So, at least that's the way that joke goes, but you'll have to ask me to hear the joke later. All right. So, the final 15% comes from the oceans and the salt lakes of the world. There are others besides the Great Salt Lake and the Dead Sea. Ultimately, the Jordan River comes out of the Sea of Galilee and comes down and hits where the Dead Sea near Jericho is. And, of course, that's where the Jordan River ends. It doesn't make it to the sea. It makes it to the Dead Sea, which is below sea level. Like it's Israel's Death Valley, great place to go in the winter. A lot of the ancient kings would go there and had homes there, and I saw some of their homes. A lot of them had swimming pools. Interesting. So swimming pools, 3,000 years old. Saw Herod's summer home down in that area. It's wonderful in the winter, but unbearably hot in the summer. Obviously taking salt out of the oceans and lakes is a very ancient method, but it's the most time-consuming and it's the most inefficient method. But you can desalinate the ocean if you need to, and some have talked about doing it because there's a lot of minerals that you can get out of the ocean, and we may need the drinking water. The world is running out of drinking water. Only 2% of the fresh water on Earth, 2%, is fit to drink. Now, people drink more of it, but only 2% is fit to drink, and yet it's literally water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink because it all has salt in it. Okay. All the ocean's salt would form a wall 180 miles high and 1 mile wide circling the Earth at the equator. That's a lot of salt. And yet, of course, look at where it is. It's in the ocean. But again, it makes you appreciate, wow, if the Great Salt Lake is 4 times saltier than that, and the Dead Sea is 13 times saltier than that, 52 times more salty than the ocean, think of the density of the salt in those. But 180 miles high, 1 mile wide, circling the Earth at the equator, so roughly 25,000 miles long. Phenomenal. The same amount would cover the continental United States with a layer of slat, as it'd be called, 1.5 miles thick. If you could pull all the salt out of the oceans, you could stack it within the continental United States 1.5 miles deep, about 7,600 feet deep. Strangely, therefore, and this is an interesting point, despite salt's seeming abundance, it is still a precious commodity today. Now, that's an irony. Wars have been fought over salt. Roman historians recorded Germanic tribes fighting over sacred salt springs. A lack of salt played an important role in the defeat of Napoleon's army during their retreat from Moscow. The famous Moscow winter hit Napoleon. Hitler didn't learn from it, and the same thing happened to him. His soldiers' wounds wouldn't heal because their bodies lacked salt. You need a certain amount of salt in your body for wounds to heal. As a result, thousands of French soldiers died retreating from Russia. While Alexander the Great was conquering the world, huge salt mines were discovered, and he worked them in northern India. Interesting. During Roman times, soldiers built what's called the Via Salaria, or the Way of Salt, which would be, or the Salt Road, we would call it, Via Salaria, the Salt Road. It's one of the greatest military roads of history, and it stretched from the salt works of Ostia, that's a town down on the southwest coast of Rome, all the way up to Rome. It was considered so valuable that the Caesars of Rome partially paid their soldiers in salt. This payment was called the Salarium Argentum, or silver salt, because it replaced money. So they were paid in what's called silver salt. And our word salary comes from it. How many of you draw a salary? Staff better raise their hands. Okay. you draw a salary. Some people get a commission check. Okay, I guess you maybe don't draw a salary, but you understand now where it comes from. It comes from salt. You're paid a salary. You're paid your salt. And it comes from, obviously, the Latin word salarium, which simply means salt. That's all it means. No mystery there. In Iran, if one is said to be untrue to salt, if a person is described that way, it means he's disloyal. Interesting. In the United States, not worth his salt originally came from Greece, where slaves were bought with salt. Slaves were purchased with salt. The slave wasn't very good. This is not worth his salt. So today you use the term, I might use the term, not worth his salt, but it's fascinating to understand what's that mean. You're not worth your salt. Well, nobody gives me salt, but you can now appreciate the meaning. You can look at your salary a little bit differently and understand how it relates to history. You know me, I love words, and words tell you stories if you will listen to them. Throughout history, this precious substance has been highly treasured as a symbol of wealth, used as money, fought over, eaten, and even considered as an important part in the sacrificial rites of many religions. And we'll see a Bible connection. Jesus didn't pick salt, brethren, as some kind of idle analogy. You're the salt of the earth. He couldn't think of anything else to say. He just didn't think to say pepper. Or you're the oregano of the earth, you know. And he just said salt and got stuck with that. Salt has unique and special properties, and they spell some very crucial and valuable lessons for all of us. If we are to be the salt of the earth that Christ says we are. So here are several points we will cover. Four. Number one. Salt is enduring. Salt endures. No one has ever heard of salt going bad. There's no such thing as, they had to throw out the salt. Yesterday I put my cereal in the bowl, and I opened this brand new half and half and ripped the top out of it and poured it in there, and it looked like sludge. Out it came. And I said, that does not look good. And I poured it right out. I thought, oh, no. And I just decided I'm not going to have it. It had gone bad. My wife tried to say, well, it's just yogurt in a half and half bottle. And I said, well, I've had yogurt. It does not look exactly like that. And so I threw it out. And I saw her yogurt later that day at lunch, and it looked different. And she had maple syrup in it and nuts and other things. That's not what I saw. But anyway, so salt does not go bad. An example of old salt, there's old salt, what is found in deposits deep in mines that are thousands of years old, and yet they're unspoiled. Never goes bad, doesn't blow up, doesn't poison anything. It's a very stable compound. Refined salt can store virtually forever. Salt, very, very enduring, and still remain salty. Salt literally cannot spoil. Pure salt cannot spoil. It is impossible to destroy its saltiness unless some other compound acts upon it chemically. It has to cease to be salt to be destroyed. Turn to Numbers chapter 18. Numbers 18. A lot of the religions of the world borrow things from the Bible, ideas from the Bible, and then twist and pervert them. You know, you check almost every religion of the world has some story about the world being flooded, and there was an ark, and a few people got on it. Sometimes those stories have 5 people on the ark, or 10 people, or 3 people, or 20 people. It's always a small number. Almost every culture in the world, the truth of the Bible is often taken and, of course, spun. When all the false doctrines of the world's churches are basically the truth spun or twisted or perverted, a little bit added, a little bit subtracted, and it's sort of the same and yet utterly different. I would liken that to sort of maybe for the moment here, pulling salt apart. I mean, if you take this very stable compound, you say, well, you know, I'll just take the sodium out of it. Look out, you've got an explosive. I'll just take the chlorine. And I've breathed chlorine a couple times when I was a lifeguard, and I would have to go get chlorine tablets. You have to be very careful. It's dangerous. And they tell you to be careful because I had to throw chlorine in the pool, and then eventually that was just too dangerous. Bromine goes into the pool. Chlorine is very deadly. As a matter of fact, we have a thing in our basement, I might just comment, where we take all the chlorine out of our water. Because the chlorine can come into your body through open pores when you're showering. I won't terrify you. Please keep showering, brethren. But at least on the Sabbath, all right? But it is a fact. And it can enter the body. It can, of course, you can drink it and so forth. And we try to purify our water. I realize there's limits to what you can do. You can't be buggy about it. But chlorine is one thing alone. It's, as I said earlier, it's very different when it's mixed with sodium. All right, now, Numbers 18, talking about heave offerings over which Aaron was given charge. Verse 19, Numbers 18 and verse 19, all the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer unto the Lord have I given you, and your sons and your daughters with you, by a statute forever. Forever. It is a covenant of salt. God inspired Moses to record forever. But God understands salt. Salt lasts. It endures before the Lord unto you and to your children with you. These offerings were thought of, described as a covenant of salt. Now, those are free will, voluntary offerings. You don't know what they were, which the Levites could share in. This covenant of salt was a lasting agreement. If you use the term, many will say we have a covenant of salt between us. It comes from Numbers 18:19. It was a lasting agreement. It was inviolable. And many times in the agreement, salt would be exchanged because it was thought between men who did it, men of honor who did it, to strengthen and make permanent and enduring the agreement. Men have done that. God certainly understands that. So he said, this is a covenant of salt whereby these offerings will be used. Turn to Mark 13 and verse 13. Mark 13:13. Now, let's just remember, the sermon is asking the question, why? In other words, what did Christ mean when he said, you and I are the salt of the earth? I hope, brethren, by the time we're done, you will never see your role as a Christian. You're not the salt just of your community. You're not the salt in the church. That'd be salting salt. We'll talk about that. You're the salt of the earth. Now, the earth has lots and lots and lots of physical salt, and yet it's a precious commodity, as we said. There are very few true Christians, those who are truly the salt of the earth. Mark 13, verse 13, and you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, a prophecy about the near future, of course, the Olivet prophecy, but he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. We're going to come back to that. Christ said that several times. He that shall endure. Now, that endurance can be demonstrated in several ways. We'll focus on three here. Turn to Mark 9. He that shall endure to the end. Now, brethren, we live in an age when most didn't endure. I've often said, it doesn't make any difference to me if there's 100 people in God's church or 160,000, as it may have been about the time of its zenith. The feast in 1990, there was 151,000. Everybody wouldn't have been at the feast. Might have been 160 or 65,000. Would it make any difference to you how many were in the church? Wouldn't make any difference. The scripture's there. If you endure to the end, the same shall be saved. It didn't make any difference if there are only three who stayed back in Sodom and Gomorrah or eight on the ark. You know, we're under 1,000 people. We're not anywhere near 160,000 people. We never will be. But you endure to the end. So obviously endurance is a vitally important quality, again, mentioned several times by Christ, for a Christian. Becomes one of the ways to understand what he meant. Mark 9 and verse 49. Mark 9, 49. For everyone shall be salted with fire. Now that's an interesting statement. This is Christ speaking again. And every sacrifice shall be salted with salt. Now, we are called, brethren, in Romans 12, I don't have time to go into all of this, but we're called living sacrifices. I've given whole sermons on that. When you become a Christian, you gave up your life. You gave up rights to it. You were bought with a price. You know the verses. You're called a living sacrifice. You no longer have rights over your life. You became, among other things, we're now learning again, the salt of the earth. For everyone shall be salted with fire, though. All right. Fire, all through the Bible, is a symbol of trial and test. God sprinkles on lives like salt. He calls it salting people. All of God's people and all people on earth, if you understand what the tribulation is called, the whole tribulation is described in Revelation as a coming fire on the whole world. It's going to purge the world. A lot of people aren't going to make it through. But fire is a symbol of trial and test. Trials produce patient endurance in those who understand. That's one of the fundamental reasons that they come. People under trial often go to pieces. Oh, I'm under a test. I can't take this. They lose it. People today are not strong. I was reading a fascinating article about what's called the compensation culture in Britain. Just back on my desk, and it came out of a London newspaper, an incredible article. One of the reasons Britain is having so many financial problems, huge problems, of course, all of the nations of the West that descended from Joseph R., I'm going to touch on that in a moment, but one of the problems is, in Britain, there is this thinking that if someone dies, somebody's got to pay for it. Somebody's a victim of something somewhere, and somebody's got to pay, and the somebody is always the government, and it's costing billions of pounds. 10 billion pounds a year to support what's called the compensation culture. You know, if somebody, I ate McDonald's, that made me fat, I'm suing McDonald's because you sure wouldn't expect me to show self-control now, would you? It's their fault. I've seen some of the pleadings in these cases. They make it smell too good and I can't resist it when I walk by. A guy actually put that in his case, incredible. Well, they're going to make it smell bad. By the way, watch Wendy's all over the nation. Now, Wendy's is advertising. The last few days, I've noticed the last week, big time, 3 stacks of beef. You know why? because they lost millions of dollars when some lady said, you know, there's a rotted finger in my chili. They finally figured out she was one of these serial litigators, and it was some guy in Las Vegas whose finger got chopped off in an industrial accident. Finger didn't look so good by the time it made its way up to San Jose, California, and even worse after the chili got all over it. And it brought a big chill to Wendy's sales. So they want customers back, you know, headquarters here in Columbus. And so they're advertising all this juiciness, all this fat, to get people back in because it sells. I don't think anybody sued Wendy's yet. But here's the point. In Britain, they're squeamish. And I was reading this article. He said, you know, we now live in a generation where people never saw war dead. In America, everybody who dies is counted and memorialized and remembered, and the liberal press just pounds on it and pounds on it. And, you know, in 20 minutes at Omaha Beach, more people died than have died in Iraq in the entire war. First 20 minutes. But you know what? You didn't have time to sort all of them out. They were dying every second. But today, there's got to be somebody pay. And, of course, the liberal courts are allowing it. People can't handle trials. I was reading yesterday about a woman whose twin daughters were killed by a drunk a year ago. You know, she's now part of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, feeling sad, and her older daughter was there, and these two beautiful 15-year-old girls, I remember when it happened a year ago, were killed by this kid who was drunk, and he was 18, and he lost control. Sad. But today, there has to be a whole series of lawsuits over it. And then you'd say, I'm not saying there wouldn't be a lawsuit to a certain degree, but who do you sue? Who do you sue? There's always an angle where there should be compensation. Somebody loses a finger. Somebody loses a foot. Somebody gets blinded in an accident. There's got to be payout. And people just aren't very strong. They cannot handle fire. They cannot be salted with fire, as Christ said. They just go to pieces. They drop to the floor, turn into a fetal position, just start bawling and shaking. I can't take this. They just don't have any strength. All right, so everyone, God says, this is just part of life. And that's why it says, Peter wrote, don't think it's strange when you endure fiery trials. It's why most people think it's strange. They want life. I do. I admit this. I would like life to be sort of a magic carpet ride. It's, you know, sipping lemonade under a tree with a gentle breeze blowing, and it's 73 degrees, and, you know, and I'm just enjoying life, and I've got a good book. Now, that we'd all like that to be life, every day, all day. And then, I'm tired. I think I'll go sleep. And, you know, then I'll get back out and hope it's 73 tomorrow. Where's the lemonade? And start another book. You see, but that's not life. That's not life. You know, billowy clouds floating over, and so forth. Okay. Natural salt can be subjected to severe tests. I mean, really severe tests, and still endure as salt. You can dissolve it in water, and it will disappear. But you drink the water, and you will taste the salt. You'll taste the salt. It can be subjected to extreme heat. How many of you knew that salt actually melts? It will melt. It will melt at 800 degrees centigrade. You can melt it, and yet it still keeps its exact same chemical properties. It appears Christ knew what he was talking about. And he wanted us to understand what he was talking about when he said we're salt. Tremendous heat and trial is coming on this world. Can you endure it? People go to pieces. Well, I'm offended. I'm offended. This happened. I'm offended. I'm quitting. I don't like this. I don't like that. And they quit. They quit. They quit jobs. They quit marriages. You know, they quit the church. You know, they quit friendships. They just quit. I didn't like this. You burnt the toast. The boss didn't give me a raise. I'm out of here. Gone are the days where people worked for the railroad for 30 years. You know, they were just tough, much stronger. Now, we ought to be able to take tremendous heat as the salt of the earth. Believe me, brethren, when you obey God, you're put under extreme pressure. I remember going to Ambassador College, and I was told the first day I arrived, Welcome to God's pressure cooker. It's also called, you know, the West Point of the work. And I was told that a year at Ambassador College was like 4 years in the out in the field. It was tough. And, of course, Satan throws every kind of temptation he possibly can at us. He throws temptations. God throws trials. You know, you'll be tested on whether you will obey God. Will you break the Sabbath? You know, will you break the Sabbath? Will you handle other temptations? There's so many out there. It's hard to even talk because of Ephesians 5:12. It's a shame to even speak of certain things that are done out there in the world. The very worst things that are going on today, trends in society, Paul says, well, I can't talk about them. There's stuff going on in schools so vile, so profoundly awful, terrible, sick, vile, that you just, I can't even tell you what it is. But researching this book was one of the most stunning things I've ever done in my life. The trials and tests thrown at people out there today are mind-boggling. They're just mind-boggling. There's never been an age like it. It's one of the reasons we're hated the world over. I'll come to that just in a moment. But we cannot compromise. All right, turn to Genesis 19. So one of the ways that we endure is we have to endure fire as Christians. Again, that could be a whole sermon, but turn to Genesis 19 and verse 26. Let's read what happened to Lot's wife. You know the story, but let's just read it here briefly. Genesis 19 and verse 26. Now they came out. God was about to pour fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. Increasingly, the world looks like. Of course, Christ said that the end of the age would be exactly like Sodom. The sun was risen upon the earth, verse 23. When Lot entered Zoar, the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire out of heaven. He overthrew those cities and all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, that which grew upon the ground. He killed everything. God says there's nothing there worth redeeming. But his wife looked back from behind him, a woman, I guess, running a little behind her husband, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, that's interesting. She became a pillar of salt. We just handed you the magazine today called The Pillar. And we are pillars. We are as Philadelphians, are seeking to be pillars in the church of God and in the kingdom of God. And, of course, you know, we are a type of Jachin and Boaz. Remember the sermon of, a couple of years ago now? And with the pillars out there as a sort of a reminder. We put the pillars on the front of the books that go to the splinters. And we're all reminded we are a pillar. Everybody will be getting the magazine. They'll be reminded that, you know, we are pillars. Well, here's a lady who became a pillar, not like any kind of pillar you and I would want to be. She became a testimony, and that's really what it means, a testimony of salt. A pillar can be a testimony. We are pillars of a right kind of testimony. She was a pillar of a wrong kind of testimony. God wanted to leave a lasting, enduring, permanent emphasis on the principle of not looking back at the old world you were called out of. She lost her life. And the two little girls running with Daddy Lot wound up with no mommy, because mommy doesn't say she stopped. She looked back from behind. Now, she might have stopped running. She may have still been running and just looked over her shoulder. I've used this analogy before. It certainly doesn't say she wanted to go back or began to go back. It just says his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And we are told in Luke 17 this. We have to be careful. You don't look back at the glitter of the world. And in the end of the age, brethren, how much more would this be incumbent on us when we're told by Christ it's going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah at the end? It's going to be like Noah's day and Sodom and Gomorrah. If ever there are people who should never think for one split second about going back to the world, looking back and going, it's us. Luke 17 and verse 26, and as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, drank, married wives, given in marriage. It looked like things were not that bad. There wasn't a lot of clouds in the sky until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. When we're taken to the place of safety, brethren, it'll still look okay. Some won't even have the faith to go. The vast majority with God's Spirit on earth, who are all part of the seventh era, aren't going to go. They're going to say, the timing's not right. Look, everything's normal. Well, what are you people so upset about? Well, where are you going? And Noah went into the ark, stayed there 7 days before the rain fell, as a matter of fact. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot. They did eat, they drank, and bought. They sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed, when Christ returns. In that day, he which shall be upon the housetop, and his stuff in the house, let him not come down to take it away. Someday, brethren, you and I will have to live this verse, and it won't be very much longer. Let him not come down to take it away, and he that's in the field, let him likewise not return back. I want to just see my house one more time. I want to say goodbye to Fido. I want to feed my fish. No, you can't do that. Why? Remember Lot's wife, verse 32. One of the three or four shortest verses in the Bible. Remember Lot's wife. Now, all Christians have to remember Lot's wife. But, brethren, for the final generation, the lesson is for us today. She turned to salt, a permanent, enduring testimony for all time. This is 2,000 years later, Christ is speaking, approximately 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years later, so it's 4,000 years ago, remember, we're told remember, but 2,000 years later, you'd say remember. If we were talking about something 2,000 years ago, we'd say remember. For us, I'd say the same. It's 4,000 years ago. Now, remember Lot's wife. Don't forget it. Don't go looking back. Don't say, well, I don't know. Maybe the world has the answers. There's so many different things that God says I have to do. Every time I open the Bible, I see something else. There's another doctrine, another this, another that. Wow. And people are coming into the church. More people coming with us, brethren, by the way, are coming from the world than they're coming from the splinters. We are probably growing faster from the world than the other groups who are losing, in some cases, people to us. We're not trying to take people from anybody. We don't have to. That's Christ's job. I wouldn't mind taking a few Lutherans, if God's calling them, or a few Baptists, and there's Catholics coming with us, there's Mormons, there's all kinds of people coming with us, and they're learning, and they're finding out, wow, there's a lot you have to do. But then you look back at the world, and you think, I don't want that either. And people coming out of the world today are different than when I was called out in 66, I'll tell you. And some of you were called later, or I don't know if any of you were before that. It is a different world. It is a different world. And some of them can't get out. They're just literally, as the parable of the seeds says, they're choked with thorns. The birds get them. The sun scorches them. Trial and tribulation just scorches them. They don't have enough root, and they just dry right out, wither, and die. I planted things that were followed by a drought, and they die. They didn't get enough root. The roots of a 15-foot olive tree in the Middle East, a 15-foot tree, that's all as tall as it is, can actually send roots down 100 feet to get water. A 15-foot tree with 100-foot roots. A great many kinds of trees that grow in the Middle East put deep roots because they know you have to have water. Of course, water is a type of the Holy Spirit. You have to have water. But some get choked. They're just choked with the thorns of the world. Everywhere you turn, there's vices and awfulness. And yet, Sodom and Gomorrah was a type of that, every kind of hideous awfulness. This young girl I was reading here, the story from the member letter, this girl who said, well, it's not sex, 12-year-old girl in a lesbian relationship, and where is she hearing right and wrong? Mr. Turk and I were talking about a book where this author described his definition of integrity this week. This is what this author said. Here is integrity. This is what the man said. Figure out what feels right and do it. That's integrity. Of course, we live in a touchy-feely world. There's no absolutes, no right and wrong. Nothing's good or bad. It's just, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? I don't know. People right now, they have feelings diaries. They write their feelings. I'm feeling anger. I'm feeling depressed. I'm feeling excited. I want to kill my friend. And they write their feelings down. So on Tuesday, a little 9-year-old girl is taught, don't stop your feelings. A little 9-year-old girl reaches over and stabs her friend to death in Brooklyn on Tuesday. You stabbed her to death right there. And the next day, a 7-year-old boy kills his 6-month-old sister, just killed her dead right there, just got mad, because nobody's telling him to control his feelings. And the police came by and said, well, we don't know, how do we arrest a 7-year-old for murder? So they just said, well, we don't know what to do. We've never seen anything like this, so we're just going to leave him with you. You've lost your baby. We don't know what to do. We'll go figure out what kind of charges we want to bring against this 7-year-old boy, so here, he's yours. We're sorry, now you have one child. Little sister. That's the world we live in. No one should want to go back to that. Luke 9:62. And Jesus said unto him, no man, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. And he could have just as easily added there, remember Lot's wife, which of course, 8 chapters later, he did. So salt is a symbol of the type of endurance we ought to have in never looking back, longing wistfully to go back into the filthy world that we came out of. Remember that sermon a few weeks ago where I quoted 1 John 5:19, the whole world lies in wickedness. That's what God says. The whole world, just the whole world, lies in wickedness. Well, I don't think it's that bad. I mean, there's problems, but everybody's doing it, and they're this and that, whatever. And you know, you got to stay with the trends, and everybody's doing this. And you read about this book that came out this week about rainbow parties. I'm going to get into that one. Rainbow parties kids are having. Now, Luke 14, and verse 34. Luke 14 and verse 34. Salt is good. Salt is good. This is Christ speaking again. But if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? In other words, you can't salt salt. We are the salt. You can't salt salt. We're the salt that salts the non-salted things. If the salt loses its savor, how are you going to season it? How do you do that? You can't. It is the seasoning for the whole earth. It is neither fit for the land, now that's interesting, nor yet for the dunghill. In other words, it's not fit for the land. You can't use it as a fertilizer. It doesn't work as a fertilizer. It's not fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill. It doesn't aid in decomposition. Salt preserves things. You can't throw it, you know, out in your compost pile. It'll work against the compost pile. It'll try to preserve it. So it's not fit for the dunghill. It's not fit for the land. You don't salt roads. I mean, you salt roads to melt snow. I guess you do that up here in the north. It doesn't add seasoning to roads. You know, it's only got certain uses. Those uses are very, very important. Now, we could ask the question, how can salt lose its saltiness? Actually, it can't, except indirectly. Now, let me explain. Salt often occurs in nature mixed with rocks, dirt, or other minerals. If this mixture is subjected to water, the salt in it will dissolve into the water and be leached out. Thus, the saltiness is lost. But isn't the salt, which has lost its saltiness, but the original substance? You take us out of the world and there's nothing left to save. God took Noah and his family out and he said, that's it. Shut the ark. Everybody else, it's over. Takes Lot and his daughters out and he says, that's it. Bring the fire and brimstone now. God has set that pattern. He's going to do it one more time. He's going to take his people out and he says, that's it. They're out. We're going to take them out of what they're mixed with. But the salt didn't lose its saltiness. the dirt, the minerals, the rocks that they were in did. There's coming a time when all of the salt's going to be taken off of the earth and put in one place. And all of the lukewarm salt is going to pay a terrible price. We all know prophecy. We don't have to go into that now. And they're gone too, though. So the saltiness is not lost in what it is. It's lost to the item that contained it after it leached out. So when Jesus warned against losing your saltiness, he meant to guard against spiritual erosion, which would water you down spiritually. Water comes in and leaches the salt out of you, and you lose your permanence. Now, brethren, you can understand the analogy here. The erosive force in this world and sin, just plain sin, will try to water you down by getting you to compromise, try to break you down so that you will become just another bland yellow pencil in a box out there in Satan's world. Satan wants you out. He wants the salt out of you. Napoleon's soldiers learned a bitter lesson. You need salt. When you're perspiring a lot, you take salt tablets. Some people take salt tablets. Farmers know, put a salt lick out there, and the cows better lick the salt. Animals need salt, and they'll lick it too. So salt is a symbol of endurance against compromise, watering you down and leaching out the precious salt from your system. Salt has a marvelous quality of endurance. Now, brethren, I would ask, do you? I'm amazed sometimes when I find out why people are considering leaving the church. I'm amazed. I've been watching it now for, I guess, almost 40 years and 35 years since I gave my first sermonette a week from today. A week from this week, second Sabbath in June, 35 years ago, I gave my first sermonette in Lafayette, Indiana, terrified. Afraid I was going to die, and thought I was going to die, and afraid I was going to live. But I still remember that, and I never cease to be amazed at people, what reasons people find to give up. I know, for instance, some people's entire religion, even some in RCG, their entire religion is to study me and watch and see if I make mistakes. They don't ever look at themselves a single time. Does Mr. Pack do this? Is he making any claims? Is he doing that? Has he made an error? Did he write something wrong? Their religion is to study me 24/7. I watch people study Mr. Armstrong 24/7. They never changed, never grew, never looked at themselves, never cried out to God to change them. Their religion was to study Mr. Armstrong. As soon as they saw flaws, they were looking for a reason to leave. And their people will study me the same. It's happened long before me or long before others before me. That's their religion. That's a religion. If I step out of line, I say something, oh, I caught you in words. That's the thing. They're looking for a reason out. And what they want is probably an easier church, a church that'll tell them they can do certain things. And they got to find a way out. They've got to check for a loose brick. I've got to get out of here. I've got to find a way to leave the church and have my conscience not scream at me. And the way to do it is to pick at me. Or whoever the leader would be down through the age. I understand that. They can't endure. I feel like with some of those people just gently saying, look, don't worry about it, just leave. Don't, just go ahead. But it's almost like they have to find something and throw a stone so they can justify, I found an error in that human being over there. And it could be others in the congregation, could be another minister, just me. But the sermonette kind of reminded me of that, about, Elisha. I was telling that story this week to an attorney, describing that very story from the sermonette, those 42 teenagers who were killed for disrespect. Kind of amazing. Imagine today. I saw a story this week. A 66-year-old bus driver had his, in Punta Gorda, Florida. If some of you saw it, it hit the news. Incredible story. 66-year-old guy, these punks, 13, 14, 15-year-olds on the bus. He pulls the bus over and radios the police and says, I got kids on my bus who are out of control. And they were just called him names. And he went back. He said, now sit down. He couldn't get them to wear their seat belts. And this one brother, he said, now sit down. He went on by. This brother mocked him and just got right in his face. And he pushed the kid down in the seat. And the kid assaulted him, and then his brother assaulted him, slapping him in the face, all right on camera. You're watching. I watch it over and over again. 66-year-old man's assaulted, boom, 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 and just spittle flying all over him. These kids hated him. And what they did, they arrested the bus driver for putting his hand on the kid, and they said there'll be no charges filed against the boys. None. 66 years old, his life is ruined. He's being charged with a felony. Oh, no, no, they're victims. They should be allowed to break rules, slap bus drivers around. The bus driver was waiting for the police. He'd done the right thing. And he knew, he said, the film will, here's what his comment was. I listened to his attorney. The film will back me up. It saw it all. They looked at the film and said, no, he's a perpetrator. They're victims. Such is the world we live in. You know, that sermonette brought it to mind when I think of these 42 kids and what they said to Elisha, and they died for it. That's a different issue. Can you endure against extreme tests, the continual siren song luring you back to the world to get you to water down and compromise? Or can you hold on, which spells endurance as a Christian? James 5 and verse 10. James 5 and verse 10. There's a law they're considering in Britain. Under no circumstances, I read the law this week, under no circumstances can you spank a child. Or the parent is a criminal, they'll be arrested. Can't touch a child. They call it smacking in Britain. You think that's bad? They're considering a law in Denmark that if you raise your voice against your child, raise your voice and intimidate that child, that's a felony. They will arrest you. You cannot raise your voice. Who knows what raising your voice is? I read that. It's astonishing. And, of course, the Commission for the Rights of Children, they said, well, we want to maintain the physical integrity of children. Just back on this other story for a moment. And we believe that striking them is making them violent. Now, all the parents of generations ago who got spanked weren't violent. The ones who, the generations who aren't getting spanked are, but nobody can add two and two and say, let's see, is that three? Two and two, maybe it's five. Maybe it's nine. It's 2.9. It's, you know, they can't add the most fundamental things and come up with the right answer. James 5 and verse 10. Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. You study the prophets and you find out what they endured. It's incredible. Behold, we count them happy which endure. That's why I say, brethren, we ought to be the happiest people on earth. If we're the most enduring, if we're the most salt-like, if we understand that if we endure to the end, we'll be saved, that itself ought to be a source of happiness. We count them happy which endure. You have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord. Look at what Christ had to go through, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy, despite what was done to him. He took it patiently. Again, Matthew 24:13 says, he that shall endure to the end shall be saved. Matthew 10:22 says, he that shall endure to the end shall be saved. And of course, in Mark 13:13, we all already read, same thing. He that shall endure to the end shall be saved. You could ask, are you enduring within God's worth? Are you worth your salt to God's work? We talk about, you've maybe heard the term, he has no salt or he's lost his salt. You've ever heard those terms? Those are both statements of ridicule and disrespect. He's got no salt. You know what that means? He lost his courage. He lost his guts. He lost his determination. He lost his ability to endure. For generations, there's been the term, he has no salt. There's no permanence to him. He lost his guts, his nerve, lost his salt. Okay, so number two, the others go faster. That was number one. Number two, salt is a disinfectant. This is fascinating. Salt can be used as a disinfectant because germs and bacteria cannot live in it. Cannot live in it. You may remember, some of you might remember this, I do, your grandmother brushing her teeth with salt. Any of you ever see, no, have relatives like, oh, a lot of you, okay. My grandmother, called her Grand Mary, she brushed her teeth with salt. It's a mild abrasive, but it has a germ-fighting quality. and makes it an effective mouthwash. Doesn't taste very good. I had to gargle with salt when I had a cold or a sore throat. My mother would always heat up salt water, and hated it. I had to go in and gargle it as a little kid, but it helped. It helped. You know, I can still remember that. Well, again, we're the salt of the earth, and we are therefore to become pure. We are those who are pure, the purest people on earth. Matthew 5 and verse 8. Matthew 5 and verse 8 says this. You already know the verse. I'll read it anyway. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God again. All right, are you? Is that you? Are you pure? Can bacteria or germs, spiritually speaking, live in you? Are you pure in motive, action? Absolutely no hypocrisy. I've given whole sermons on that. We are, in effect, like a spiritual disinfectant to the world. It's just that the world is involved in it as an overwhelming, massive infection, and it is resistant. I mean, it's filled with superbugs, if you can use the analogy. Doctors use this term now, superbugs. And sin is almost like a culture of bacteria or germs, if you think about it. And there's a culture out there, quite literally a culture, but a culture of sin in the world. And it is every parasite, bacteria, and germ known to man, the worst time in the history of the world. And we, as a certain kind of disinfectant, should be fighting against sin, first of all, of course, in our own life, to keep it from multiplying. That's what bacteria do. I was reading about this particular bacterial infection. I can't remember what it was. Was it this new Staph aureus, this new superbug where you get it? I don't think that's what it was. I was reading to several different ones this week. And you can go in 24 hours, you can go from one bacteria, one of this particular type of bacteria, to 60 million in your body in 24 hours. 1 to 60 million in 24 hours. There's different types of bacterial infections that are just unbelievable. My father died of a bacterial infection, sepsis, and it just spreads and explodes through the body. And sin can be that way. It spreads. It's not static. It grows. And you have to keep it from multiplying. And salt is the opposite of leavening. It's the opposite of leavening. Turn to Mark 9:50. Now we read 9:49. Let's go read 9:50. The point again is salt is a disinfectant. Now Mark 9:50. Salt is good. Okay, there's plain statement. Salt is good, but if the salt have lost its saltiness or saltness, wherewith will you season it? Again, we read that earlier. You can't salt salt. But now it goes on and says, have salt in yourselves. I'll just take the statement. As Christ said it, have salt in yourselves. Isn't just talking about physical salt. That's obvious. And, now notice this, interesting, and have peace one with another. Now, ultimately, the greatest single thing the world needs is peace. That's the single greatest thing the world needs is peace. There's no peace. There's no peace. You turn on the news, there's always something horrible happening. Always. I mean, just the bombings. I read that 12,000 Iraqis as of yesterday have been blown up, largely by their countrymen or insurgents. And that's an incredible number. Of course, it's a whole lot more than the soldiers we've lost. And yet it's a whole lot less than the 50 to 100 million, depending upon how you count it, that Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler killed in World War II. Stalin killed up to 20 million Russians prior to the war, and you know, and then Hitler, depending upon how you count it, some are not found. I saw a picture this week in a film in Yugoslavia of an execution. I saw them executed. If you see that, that's just every day. It's just unbelievable, and you know, the war crimes that are taking place. But there's so much war today. You know, I've been going over the lack of peace on earth as the United States economy continues to melt down and the dollar continues to grow weaker there are four great power blocks in the world who will hate us for entirely different reasons. And it all, in many ways, comes back to the dollar, and yet in other ways it doesn't. Let me explain. Let me explain for a moment why the world is so nervous about the condition of the economy, even Greenspan. I mean, I read lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of what people say, and the top economists are very worried. It benefits the work, and about only the work, when the dollar continues to grow weaker because other currencies, people tithe in other currencies, it translates into more dollars. So for us it's good, and about everybody else it's bad. Now, in the last 20 years, the Chinese, for instance, look at Asia, Japan, South Korea, and China, China in particular, 400 million Chinese have been lifted above the poverty line by the movement toward capitalism. 400 million of them. You know who's buying the products made in China? It's unemploying a lot of Americans. It's America. So we are bringing in a lot more because we're now a consuming country, basically not a producing or exporting country. We import. All right, that reduces the value of our dollar around the world. And so the Chinese are one of the biggest governments that buy treasury notes at the regular auctions as we sell our debt. We have to get people to buy our debt so we can continue to live beyond their means. When people live beyond their means, they go bankrupt. But if governments do it, they find somebody stupid enough to buy their debt, but the Chinese have to buy our debt, and they know, we have them over a barrel. Because they have to buy our debt, they can't let our economy collapse, or their economy collapses because they can't keep dumping their goods in this country over here. They need those 400 million Chinese to stay above the poverty line. And begin to understand why the men of the East are starting to get more angry. And then, of course, there's issues with North Korea, South Korea, and Japan. And it's America that's causing the problem. And there's more and more a sort of a tendency to go to a basket of currencies. Don't just hold dollars. Don't keep your reserves in dollars. Well, I want to tell you, in Africa, the feelings, more and more voices are saying colonialism was better for Africa than African dictators. Whether it's Zimbabwe, Rwanda, just watched that movie the other day, warlords all over Ethiopia, that just the slaughter of Sudanese, there's AIDS and drought and disease of every kind across Africa, and the richest nations are supposed to make it all go away, and they can't. So the colonialists who were driven out are now being blamed for getting out because they didn't prepare people to rule themselves. Well, you couldn't. You couldn't. I mean, there's no way to prepare a continent of now a billion people. So who's at fault? America. Of course, across the Middle East, we conducted this illegal war in Iraq. That's the way it's seen. So from the southern Philippines to Libya, from the Balkans to North Central Africa, where 1 billion Arabs live, there is ferocious hatred. And, of course, they see us exporting all of this rotten garbage from Hollywood and porn on websites and vile, not immoral, amoral living that's affecting their youth. They see those trends coming out. And I mean, you know, some countries, Saudi Arabia, you commit adultery, they're trying to reverse the law. Turkey just decided, well, maybe we won't execute women for committing adultery. They don't execute the men, but they thought they'd execute the women. Well, the European Union said, you execute women for adultery, guess what? You don't get into the European Union, so the Turkish parliament dropped the law. So, okay, we won't do that. But that's the way the Islamics think. You steal, off goes your hand, or off goes your head. You see? So they see all this vile immorality, and there's no doubt why they hate us. You go to Europe, now there's a fourth power block. There's a man named Benedict the 16th who hates the American press because it's vilified, you know, a lot of pedophile priests. They hate the abortion. They hate euthanasia. They hate the condom ads that came out on Wednesday night. The Vatican hates those ads and is fighting against it. And they're looking for a conservative leader, and maybe they found one in Bavaria. And at the same time, the Israelites are voting to get out of the Constitution. They're pulling out. Reuben, it's dead. Everybody says it's dead. And you're never going to get it. And, of course, Israel gets punished by the beast. They're not part of the beast. I don't care what certain confused ministers who should know better say. One minister out there who should know better says America's the beast, given a whole series of sermons on it. But, brethren, we have to understand, we have to watch, we have to recognize these different moods. Joseph is hated. The Chinese, the Europeans, You know, the Germans are saying, please get your economy in order. Our fragile economy is coming back. If those dollars don't get straightened out, we can't sell any more Mercedes-Benzes and our economy is going to sink. Europe's saying the same thing the Chinese are. They're mad. And America says, now you have to keep buying our treasury notes because we got all these consumers here that want to keep shopping at Walmart and overspending and overspending and overspending. And, of course, we're setting example for them. We're overspending, too. And, you know, we're not going to pull back. And you've got to keep buying the notes because you know if you take us down, if you just say we won't buy the treasury notes anymore, you go down with us, so you'll keep buying our treasury notes. And they see that arrogance, and they're trying to get around it, and more, of course, are moving toward euros. I don't talk a lot about this, brethren, because I don't have that much time, but, I mean, you understand the hatred. We have to endure. Lots and lots and lots of fire is coming. I mean fire like the world has never seen, and we had better be ready for it. My counsel is be sure that you have salt in yourselves, because we are the salt of the earth. Turn to Leviticus 2 and verse 13. Leviticus 2 and verse 13. And every oblation, God inspired Moses to write, every oblation, first fruits offering described there, of your meat offering, shall you season with salt. Neither shall you suffer the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your meat. God says, every time you have a sacrifice, I want salt there because it reflects the enduring permanent covenant you have with your God. Your meat offerings, all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Brethren, we are going to be, and we are teaching that the world is going to come to peace. The most important thing that Christ needs to bring is peace. There's war everywhere, and that was my point earlier, and I didn't want to get away from it. Right now, we are bringing the good news of the gospel of the soon coming kingdom of God, which Paul also called peace, and it wasn't a separate gospel. You know, anciently, when people ate together and the food contained salt, even the bitterest of enemies would decide that during the meal they would be friends. They would be friends. There is an old Arab expression, there is salt between us, or he has eaten my salt. And it was said to cement a friendship and to mean peace between people. He has eaten my salt. There is salt between us. Again, we are the salt of the earth. The catalytic agent, we are called peacemakers. Can you bring peace? Christ will rule from the city of peace. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Salem, the city of peace. He is called the King of Peace. We must be peacemakers. We are the salt of the earth and a kind of a catalytic agent that is restoring peace to the earth. We are the kingdom of God in embryo. We, wherever we go, disinfecting germs spread and kill the danger of infection. There aren't many of us, and it won't be enough to stop what yet has to happen, and the punishment that is to occur won't be enough. But at the end of the day, with Christ coming, it will be. Number three, salt is precious. We still talk about a person not worth his salt. And salt is still, even in these times, a rare and sometimes an expensive commodity. Think of salt on a steak, a piece of salt. Now, there's only less than 1,000 of us, considerably less than 1,000 of us, I suppose. A piece of salt on a steak, generally on average, a steak's about 80,000 times as big as the piece of salt, as a piece of salt. And if there are, less than 1,000 of us in a world of 6.4 billion people, it's not a lot of salt. And yet, if you think about it, and we'll come in a moment, our place on earth is holding something back. I'll show you that in a moment. Salt is precious as a seasoning. I hope that we are seasoning the steak that is this earth as much as we should, adding the zest, the relish, the enjoyment, the pleasure, showing that there are happy people on earth in a world drowning in a sea of misery and stress and confusion and people who don't know where to turn. You know, what would life be like without salt? It'd be kind of bland. The world would be a worse place. What would the world be like without us? You might ask yourself. If there was nobody else like you, so you start with yourself, don't say the rest of the church, if all the people like me, meaning you, me, whoever, were gone, what would that change the earth? What if the earth was missing a whole lot of people like you? What difference would that make? Would the world miss the flavor that a lot of yous bring? And we say, oh, collectively the church. I mean just you for a moment. Turn to Job 6 and verse 6. Job 6 and verse 6. Fascinating verse in light of the question I just asked you. Job 6, 6. Just a couple more verses here. Job 6 and verse 6. Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? No. The earth has to have salt. Is there any taste in the white of an egg? You know, 3,000 years ago, the question was the same as we'd say today. You know, the yolk, yes. I put stuff on my eggs. It's wonderful. But it's the white, not so good. Try to enjoy the white of an egg, cooked or not. Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? And the answer is, you can, but it's not going to be very good. You know, my mother showed us when we were kids, we'd poke a pinhole in one end of an egg and poke a little bigger hole in the other end of the egg and suck the egg right out. Did you ever do that? You know, it came out without salt. And I did it because she said you could do it. And so I remember poking the hole and the little hole. So that just for the air to get in behind the egg. And now suck, David. Oop. Okay. It worked. Out came the whole egg. She said, now break it open. There'll be no egg in there. And I did. That's right. There's no egg in there. And it was terrible. And I did it once. Colossians 4 and verse 6. I had an amazing mother, didn't I? I tell stories. I got more stories. You can't even imagine the stories I have from my mother. I had a neat childhood. Colossians 4 and verse 6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt. Every time you open your mouth, brethren, and you talk to other people, do you get out the salt shaker and just sort of flip it on the tongue, so to speak? Do you do that? Let your speech be always with grace. There are people who just, they're gracious the way they talk. They're just gracious. Seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. Well, some people can talk to a truck driver. Other people can talk to a computer technician. Other people can talk to an engineer. But it's an extraordinary person who can talk to salesmen and teachers and housewives and the bricklayer and the lady at the daycare center, and everybody can talk to everybody. And if you have salt mixed with grace in your speech all the time, and you can answer every man, you've pleased God. That's what He wants. We are the salt of the earth. Again, does our presence make a difference? In your family, your neighborhood, your town, this world, it should. God considers us the most precious commodity in the world. Point four, salt is a preservative. It's a preservative. Okay. During the 1500s and 1600s, men exploring the New World in ships preserved their meat during the long ocean voyages by soaking them in salt water. Soldiers were given their salt pork. I mean, this meat could be old, and it could take the sun, and nothing could live in it. Now, bad enough to eat pork, but I guess if you have to eat pork, eat it with salt in it, and, you know, this stuff, that's what the soldiers did. A lot of them got scurvy and other things. They had to learn they had to add other things. But on these long voyages, they soaked it in salt, and the meat stayed good over and back. The brine solution kept the meat from spoiling, and it's still used today in pickling. We use the term I wanted to salt it away. I had to salt away. My dad would say, now, son, salt away some money. It meant save or preserve, keep, salt it away. Salt is a preservative of life itself. All animals need it to survive. I was talking about the cows, others, the salt licks out there. Animals will travel great distances and risk their lives to get it. Remember how Napoleon's men lacked it, and it cost thousands of them their lives. It's essential for the health, the well-being and the life of every person on earth. Final verse, turn to Malachi 4 and verse 5. Malachi 4 and verse 5. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet. We all know this verse, but let's look at it from a different perspective. Before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, somebody had to fulfill the role of Elijah the prophet. People don't want it to be Mr. Armstrong. Well, that's their problem. It has to be somebody. Of course, people who don't want to hold to his teachings would be much more comfortable thinking it'll be somebody yet ahead who will restore all things, as Matthew 17:11 said, yet ahead, and that we can still now play with doctrine, but they're confused. But here's the point. Somebody came, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, the heart of the children to their fathers. Changes occurred in families between fathers and sons and between physical Israel and the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, several ways to take this. Lest I come and smite the earth with utter destruction. It says a curse, but you understand the Hebrew is kerem, C-H-E-R-E-M. It means utter destruction. God says, in effect, he would destroy earth if it were not for a few people who we now understand are salt. We literally, brethren, let's understand this, if you keep yourself salty, we literally are preserving the world. Now there comes a point where Lot and his daughters left, Noah and his family left, and the earth gets destroyed behind them. But the reason God has not destroyed this earth is because there are true Christians who still understand you are the salt of the earth. And the salt must not lose its savor. We are the salt of the earth. If we're gone, the earth is good for nothing. We're good for nothing. We have to endure the salty, fiery trials. We cannot look back to this world. We cannot water down our Christianity through compromise. We are this world's spiritual disinfectant, ridding it wherever we go, as it were, of filthy, corrupt germs. The worst germs of all are the germs of war. You know, when a suicide bomber goes off, it doesn't make any difference if an 80-year-old grandma turns into body parts and is blasted into walls. They have people, special people, to come and scrub people out of brick. Special people. They have to use special stuff. There are 600 of them in Israel. They're trained to remove people from everything they fly into. And they chant and they sing as they do it. Wherever we go, in a sense, we are disinfecting that worst of all viruses. Blessed are the peacemakers. They are the children of God. There are precious few of us in this world, and we are this world's only hope as we seek, through God's method, through the balance of prophecy and the little bit of time left in this age, to preserve it.